Will it be possible for any one of the partners to assure themselves of the sincerity of the intentions of the others? The untitled memorandum Bohr prepared for Franklin Roosevelt in Washington in 1944 went to Felix Frankfurter for review on July 5th, along with a cover letter apologizing for its inadequacies. Bohr worried through the hot night and composed another apology the next day. "I have had serious anxieties," he confided, "that the memorandum may not correspond to your expectations and perhaps not at all be suited for the purpose." Frankfurter had the good sense to recognize the document's merit. It is still the only comprehensive and realistic charter for a post-nuclear world, and about a week later told Bohr he had handed it to the president. Bohr and his son left Washington soon after, on a Friday in mid-July, to work at Los Alamos, understanding that Roosevelt would arrange a meeting in good time. That time came in August, as the president prepared to meet the prime minister in Quebec. Bohr returned to the U.S. Capitol. On August 26th at 5 p.m., he writes, "B was received by the president in the White House in a completely private manner. Roosevelt was very cordial and in excellent spirits," says Aga Bohr, as well he might have been after the rapid advances of the Allied armies across Europe. He had read Bohr's memorandum. He most kindly gave B an opportunity to explain his views and spoke in a very frank and encouraging manner about the hopes he himself entertained. FDR liked to charm. He charmed Bohr with stories, Aga Bohr recounts. Roosevelt agreed that an approach to the Soviet Union of the kind suggested must be tried, and said that he had the best hopes that such a step would achieve a favorable result. In his opinion, Stalin was enough of a realist to understand the revolutionary importance of this scientific and technical advance and the consequences it implied. Roosevelt described in this connection the impression he had received of Stalin at the meeting in Tehran, and also related humorous anecdotes of his discussion and debates with Churchill and Stalin. He mentioned that he had heard how the negotiations with Churchill in London had gone, but added that the latter had often reacted in this way at the first instance. However, Roosevelt said, he and Churchill always managed to reach agreement, and he thought that Churchill would eventually come around to sharing his point of view in this matter. He would discuss the problems with Churchill at their forthcoming meeting, and hoped to see my father soon afterwards. The interview lasted an hour and a half. To Robert Oppenheimer in 1948, Bohr reported a more specific commitment from the president. He left with Professor Bohr the impression, Oppenheimer writes, that after discussion with the prime minister, he might well ask Bohr to undertake an exploratory mission to the Soviet Union. It is hardly necessary to mention the encouragement and gratitude my father felt after his talk with Roosevelt, Aga Bohr goes on. These were days filled with the greatest optimism and expectation. Bohr saw Frankfurter in Boston and told him about the meeting. Frankfurter suggested Bohr restate his case in a thank you note, which Bohr managed to compress into one long page by September 7th. Frankfurter passed it to Roosevelt's aide. Bohr settled in eagerly to wait. The two heads of state saved their tube alloy discussions for the end of the conference, late September, when they retreated to Roosevelt's estate in the Hudson Valley at Hyde Park. "This was another piece of black comedy," writes C.P. Snow. Roosevelt surrendered without struggle to Churchill's view of Bohr. The result was a secret aide-memoire, obviously of Churchill's composition, that misrepresented Bohr's proposals, repudiated them, and recorded for the first time the Anglo-American position on the new weapon's first use. The suggestion that the world should be informed regarding tube alloys, with a view to an international agreement regarding its control and use, is not accepted. The matter should continue to be regarded as of the utmost secrecy, but when a bomb is finally available, it might, perhaps, after mature consideration, be used against the Japanese, who should be warned that this bombardment will be repeated until they surrender. 2. Full collaboration between the United States and the British government in developing tube alloys for military and commercial purposes should continue after the defeat of Japan, unless and until terminated by joint agreement. 3. Inquiries should be made regarding the activities of Professor Bohr and steps taken to ensure that he is responsible for no leakage of information, particularly to the Russians. The next day, September 20th, Churchill wrote Cherwell in high dudgeon. "The President and I are much worried about Professor Bohr. How did he come into this business? He is a great advocate of publicity. He made an unauthorized disclosure to Chief Justice Frankenfurter, who startled the President by telling him he knew all the details. He says he is in close correspondence with a Russian professor, an old friend of his in Russia, to whom he has written about the matter and may be writing still. The Russian professor has urged him to go to Russia in order to discuss matters. What is all this about? It seems to me Bohr ought to be confined, or at any rate made to see that he is very near the edge of mortal crimes. I had not visualized any of this before. I do not like it at all." Anderson, Halifax, and Cherwell all defended Bohr to Churchill after the Hyde Park outburst, as did Bush and Conant to FDR. The Danish laureate was not confined. But neither was he invited to meet again with the President of the United States. There would be no exploratory mission to the USSR. How much the world lost that September is immeasurable. The complementarity of the bomb, its mingled promise and threat, would not be canceled by the decisions of heads of state. Their frail authority extends not nearly so far. Nuclear fission and thermonuclear fusion are not acts of parliament. They are levers embedded deeply in the physical world, discovered because it was possible to discover them, beyond the power of men to patent or to hoard. Edward Teller had arrived at Los Alamos in April of its founding in 1943, prepared to participate fully in its work. He was then 35 years old, dark, with bushy, mobile black eyebrows, and a heavy, uneven step. Youthful, Stanislaw Ulam remembers, always intense, visibly ambitious, and harboring a smoldering passion for achievement in physics. He was a warm person and clearly desired friendship with other physicists. Teller's son Paul, his first child, had been born in February. The Tellers had shipped to the primitive New Mexico Mesa two machines they considered vital to their peace of mind. A Steinway concert grand piano Michi Teller had bought for her husband for $200 at a Chicago hotel sale, and a new Bendix automatic washer. They were assigned an apartment. The Steinway nearly filled the living room. Teller had striven on behalf of nuclear energy since Bohr's first public announcement of the discovery of fission in Washington in 1939. He had helped Robert Oppenheimer organize Los Alamos and recruit its staff. He expected to contribute to the planning of the new laboratory's program, and he did. It was essential that the whole laboratory agree on one or a very few major lines of development, writes Hans Bethe, and that all else be considered of low priority. Teller took an active part in the decision on what were to be the major lines. A distribution of work among the members of the theoretical division was agreed upon in a meeting of all scientists of the division, and Teller again had a major voice. But Teller had received no concomitant administrative appointment that April, and the omission aggrieved him. He was qualified to lead the theoretical division. Oppenheimer appointed Hans Bethe instead. He was qualified to lead a division devoted to work toward a thermonuclear fusion weapon, a super, but no such division was established. The laboratory had decided at its opening conference, and the Lewis Committee had affirmed in May, that thermonuclear research should be restricted largely to theoretical studies and held to distant second priority behind fission. An atomic bomb, since it would trigger any thermonuclear arrangement, necessarily came first. There was a war on, and manpower was limited. "That I was named to head the theoretical division," Bethe comments, "was a severe blow to Teller, who had worked on the bomb project almost from the day of its inception, and considered himself, quite rightly, as having seniority over everyone then at Los Alamos, including Oppenheimer." Bethe believed he was chosen because his more plodding but steadier approach to life and science would serve the project better at that stage of its development, where decisions had to be adhered to and detailed calculations had to be carried through, and where, therefore, a good deal of administrative work was inevitable. Teller saw his old friend's steadier approach differently. Betha was given the job to organize the effort, and in my opinion, in which I may well have been wrong, he over-organized it. It was much too much of a military organization, a line organization. On the other hand, Teller has repeatedly praised Oppenheimer's direction of Los Alamos, direction which included Betha's appointment and ratified Betha's decisions. Throughout the war years, Oppie knew in detail what was going on in every part of the laboratory. He was incredibly quick and perceptive in analyzing human as well as technical problems. Of the more than 10,000 people who eventually came to work at Los Alamos, Oppie knew several hundred intimately, by which I mean that he knew what their relationships with one another were and what made them tick. He knew how to organize, cajole, humor, soothe feelings, how to lead powerfully without seeming to do so. He was an exemplar of dedication, a hero who never lost his humanness. Disappointing him somehow carried with it a sense of wrongdoing. Los Alamos's amazing success grew out of the brilliance, enthusiasm, and charisma with which Oppenheimer led it. I believe maybe Teller resented my being placed on top of him, Betha concludes. He resented even more that there would be an end to free and general discussion. He resented even more that he was removed by lack of administrative contact from Oppenheimer. The theoretical complexity of the super challenged Teller as the fission bomb had not. It also offered a line of work along which he might lead. When Los Alamos was established in the spring of 1943, he writes, and the technical history of the laboratory confirms, the exploration of the super was among its objectives. He accepted the postponement of that exploration through the summer of 1943, helping Betha with the more immediate problem of developing means to calculate the critical mass and nuclear efficiency of various bomb designs. During the summer, experimental studies at Purdue found that the fusion reaction cross-section for deuterium was much larger than expected. Teller cited the result to the Purdue Los Alamos Governing Board in September to propose renewing the super investigation. Then John von Neumann arrived on the Hill to endorse and extend Seth Neddermeyer's implosion work, and for a few months Teller was caught up in reconnoitering that new territory. Emilio Segre won a new workshop that 1943 autumn. At Berkeley, he had measured the rate of spontaneous fission, naturally occurring fission without neutron bombardment, in uranium and plutonium. The measurements were difficult because the rates were low for the small sample Segre had to use, but they were crucial. They determined how cleansed of light element impurities the bomb cores would have to be. There was no point in purifying past the spontaneous background. And they determined how fast the gun assemblies would have to fire to avoid pre-detonation. Segre moved off the Los Alamos Mesa to protect his new and more capacious measuring instruments from the radiation other experiments generated there. At this time, I acquired a special small laboratory for measuring spontaneous fission, the like of which I have never seen before or since. It was a log cabin that had been occupied by a ranger, and it was located in a secluded valley a few miles from Los Alamos. It could be reached only by a jeep trail that passed through fields of purple and yellow asters, and a canyon whose walls were marked with Indian carvings. On this trail, we once found a large rattlesnake. The cabin laboratory, in a grove shaded by huge broadleaf trees, occupied one of the most picturesque settings one could dream of. In December, at this Pajarito Canyon field station, Segre made a significant discovery. The spontaneous fission rate for natural uranium was much the same at the field station as at Berkeley, but at the field station, the rate was seemingly higher for U-235. Segre deduced that cosmic ray neutrons, which were usually too slow to fission U-238 but effective to fission U-235, caused the difference. Cosmic rays batter neutrons from the upper reaches of the atmosphere, and the field station was 7,300 feet nearer that region than was sea level Berkeley. Shield out such stray neutrons, and the U-235 bomb core could be purified less rigorously than they had assumed. Pre-detonation would be less likely. The gun that assembled the U-235 to critical mass would need less muzzle velocity and could be significantly shorter and lighter. Thus was Little Boy engendered, Thin Man's modest brother, a gun assembly 6 feet long instead of 17 that would weigh less than 10,000 pounds, an easy load for a B-29. In a log cabin, in a grove, beyond fields of bright asters, up a trail, visited by rattlesnakes. Gun research was already advanced. The first task of the gun group, Edwin McMillan remembers, was to set up a test stand where experiments could be done. You have to have a gun emplacement and a gun and a sand butt, which is nothing but a huge box full of sand that you fire projectiles into so that you can find the pieces afterwards, and because there might be somebody else out there. The site they chose was Anchor Ranch, a former working ranch 3 miles southwest of the mesa that the Army had bought as part of the reservation. They fired the first shot on September 17, 1943. Until the following March, the group used a 3-inch Navy anti-aircraft gun fitted with unrifled barrels. With it, they tested propellants, eventually choosing cordite, and studied scale model projectiles and targets. Knowing that the uranium bullet would complete a critical assembly, they decided that it should not impact upon the target core, but pass freely through. Within microseconds of its arrival at spherical configuration, it would in any case have vaporized. From the beginning, the plutonium gun, with its nearly unattainable muzzle velocity of 3,000 feet per second, had been a gamble. When von Neumann that autumn celebrated the advantages of implosion, the governing board gave the novel approach its strong endorsement. Through the fall and early winter of 1943, Neddermeyer's experiments made only slow progress, however. He added few men to his group. He continued to work methodically with metal cylinders, wrapped with solid slabs of high explosive. By spacing several detonators symmetrically around the wrap, he could start implosions simultaneously at different points on the HE surface. From each point of detonation, a detonation wave, shaped like an expanding bubble, would travel inward toward the metal cylinder. By varying the spacing of the detonators and the thickness of the HE, Neddermeyer hoped to find a configuration that smoothed the convex multiple shock waves to one uniform cylindrical squeeze. He was working to the same end with small metal balls, scale models of an eventual bomb core. But the first successful HE flash photographs of imploding cylinders, notes the Los Alamos Technical History, showed that there were very serious asymmetries in the form of jets which traveled ahead of the main mass. A number of interpretations of these jets were proposed, including the possibility that they were optical illusions. They were all too real. "Absolutely awful results," says Bethe. Oppenheimer decided Neddermeyer needed help. Groves agreed. Conant knew just the man. Everything in books about the Manhattan Project looks so simple, so easy, and everybody was friends with everybody, George Kistiakowsky told an audience wryly long after the war. He remembered a different Los Alamos. The tall, outspoken, Ukrainian-born Harvard chemist had begun studying explosives for the National Defense Research Committee in 1940. By 1943, I thought I knew something about them. What he knew about them was original and unorthodox. That they could be made into precision instruments, a view which was very different from that of military ordnance. He had already won von Neumann to his view, which had prepared the Hungarian mathematician in turn to endorse the precision instrument of implosion. Conant similarly trusted Kistiakowsky's judgment. In 1941, Conant had abandoned his skepticism toward the atomic bomb because of Kistiakowsky. Now, the explosives expert found the Harvard president seeking his help to advance Neddermeyer's work. "I began going to Los Alamos as a consultant in the fall of 1943, and then pressure was put on me by Oppenheimer and General Groves, and particularly by Conant, which really mattered, to go there on full time. I didn't want to, partly because I didn't think the bomb would be ready in time, and I was interested in helping win the war. I also had what looked like an awfully interesting overseas assignment all fixed up for myself. Well, instead, unwillingly, I went to Los Alamos. That gave me a wonderful opportunity to act as reluctant bride throughout the life of the project, which helped at times. Kistiakowsky arrived in late January 1944 and took up residence in a small stone cabin that had been the ranch school's pump house, an accommodation he negotiated in preference to the men's dormitory. He was 44 years old and divorced. He quickly discovered, as he suspected, that everything was not easy, and everybody was not friends. After a few weeks, I found that my position was untenable because I was essentially in the middle trying to make sense of the efforts of two men who were at each other's throats. One was Captain Deke Parsons, who tried to run his division the way it is done in military establishments, very conservative. The other was, of course, Seth Neddermeyer, who was the exact opposite of Parsons, working away in a little corner. The two never agreed about anything, and they certainly didn't want me interfering. While Kistiakowsky struggled with that dilemma, the theoreticians began to glimpse how a successful implosion mechanism might be designed. The previous spring, the Polish mathematician Stanisław Ulam, then 34 years old and a member of the faculty at the University of Wisconsin, had found himself unhappy merely teaching in the midst of war. It seemed a waste of my time. I felt I could do more for the war effort. He had noticed that letters from his old friend John von Neumann often bore Washington rather than Princeton postmarks, and deduced that von Neumann was involved in war work. Now he wrote, asking for advice. Von Neumann proposed they meet between trains in Chicago to talk, and turned up impressively chaperoned by two bodyguards. Eventually, Hans Bethe sent along an official invitation. In the winter of 1943, Ulam and his wife Francois, who was then 2 months pregnant, rode the Santa Fe chief to New Mexico, as so many others had done before them. The sun shone brilliantly, the air was crisp and heady, and it was warm even though there was a lot of snow on the ground, a lovely contrast to the rigors of winter in Madison. The day of his arrival, Ulam met Edward Teller for the first time. He was assigned to Teller's group, who talked to me on that first day about a problem in mathematical physics that was part of the necessary theoretical work in preparation for developing the idea of a superbomb. Teller's preemption of Ulam's first days at Los Alamos for super calculations was symptomatic of the discord that had been widening between him and Hans Bethe, who needed every available theoretical physicist and mathematician to concentrate on the difficult problem of implosion. Teller had contributed enthusiastically and crucially to the most interesting part of the work. However, Bethe complains, he declined to take charge of the group which would perform the detailed calculations on the implosion. Since the theoretical division was very short-handed, it was necessary to bring in new scientists to do the work that Teller declined to do. That was one reason the British team had been invited to Los Alamos. Teller recalls no specific refusal. Bethe wanted me to work on calculational details, at which I'm not particularly good, he counters, while I wanted to continue not only on the hydrogen bomb, but on other novel subjects. The Los Alamos Governing Board reevaluated the super once again in February 1944, learning that despite deuterium's more favorable cross-section, it would still be difficult to ignite. A super would almost certainly require tritium. The small tritium samples studied so far had been transmuted in a cyclotron by bombarding lithium with neutrons. Large-scale tritium production, like large-scale plutonium production, would require production reactors, but the piles at Hanford were unfinished and previously committed. Both because of the theoretical problem still to be solved, and because of the possibility that the super would have to be made with tritium, reports the Los Alamos Technical History, it appeared that the development would require much longer than originally anticipated. Work could continue. The super was too portentous a weapon to ignore, but only to the extent that it did not interfere with the main program. Von Neumann soon drafted Ulam to help work out the hydrodynamics of implosion. The problem was to calculate the interactions of the several shock waves as they evolved through time, which meant trying to reduce the continuous motion of a number of moving, interacting surfaces to some workable mathematical model. The hydrodynamical problem was simply stated, Ulam comments, but very difficult to calculate, not only in detail, but even in order of magnitude. He remembers in particular a long discussion early in 1944 when he questioned all the ingenious shortcuts and theoretical simplifications which von Neumann and other physicists suggested. He had argued instead for simple-minded brute force, that is, more realistic, massive numerical work. Such work could not be done reliably by hand with desktop calculating machines. Fortunately, the laboratory had already ordered IBM punch card sorters to facilitate calculating the critical mass of odd-shaped bomb cores. The IBM equipment arrived early in April 1944, and the theoretical division immediately put it to good use, running brute force implosion numbers. Hydrodynamic problems, detailed and repetitious, were particularly adaptable to machine computation. The challenge apparently set von Neumann thinking about how such machines might be improved. Then a member of the newly arrived British mission made a proposal that paid his mission's way. James L. Tuck was a tall, rumpled Cherwell protege from Oxford who had worked in England developing shaped charges for armor-piercing shells. A shaped charge is a charge of high explosive arranged in such a way, usually hollowed out like an empty ice cream cone with the open end pointed forward, that its normally divergent bubble-shaped shockwave converges into a high-speed jet. Such a ferocious jet can punch its way through the thick armor of a tank to spray death inside. It had just become clear from theoretical work that the several diverging shockwaves produced by multiple detonators in Neddermeyer's experiments reinforced each other where they collided and produced points of high pressure. Such pressure nodes in turn caused the jets and irregularities that spoiled the implosion. Rather than continue trying to smooth out a colliding collection of divergent shockwaves, Tuck sensibly proposed that the laboratory consider designing an arrangement of explosives that would produce a converging wave to begin with, fitting the shockwave to the shape it needed to squeeze. Such explosive arrangements were called lenses by analogy with optical lenses that similarly focus light. No one wanted to tackle anything so complex so late in the war. Geoffrey Taylor, the British hydrodynamicist, arrived in May to offer further insight into the problem. He had developed an understanding of what came to be called Raleigh-Taylor instabilities, instabilities formed at the boundaries between materials. Accelerate heavy material against light material, he demonstrated mathematically, and the boundary between the two will be stable. But accelerate light material against heavy material, and the boundary between the two will be unstable and turbulent, causing the two materials to mix in ways extremely difficult to predict. High explosive was light compared to tamper. All of the tamper materials under consideration except uranium were significantly lighter than plutonium. Raleigh-Taylor instabilities would constrain subsequent design. They would also make it difficult to predict bomb yield. As the IBM results clarified shockwave behavior, the physicists began seriously to doubt if a uniform wrap of HE could ever be made to produce a symmetrical explosion. Complex, though explosive lenses might be, they were apparently the only way to make implosion work. Von Neumann turned to their formulation. You have to assume that you can control the velocity of the detonation wave in a chemical explosive very accurately, Kistiakowsky explains. So if you start the wave at certain points by means of detonators, you can predict exactly where it will be at a given time. Then you can design the charge. It was soon clear that the velocity of the converging shockwaves from the several explosive lenses that would surround the bomb core could vary by no more than 5%. That was the demanding limit within which von Neumann designed, and Kistiakowsky, Neddermeyer and their staffs began to work. In the spring of 1944, the two difficult personal conflicts between Teller and Bethe and between Kistiakowsky and Neddermeyer forced Oppenheimer to intervene. First, Bethe writes, Teller withdrew from fission development. With the pressure of work and lack of staff, the theoretical division could ill afford to dispense with the services of any of its members, let alone one of such brilliance and high standing as Teller. Only after 2 failures to accomplish the expected and necessary work, and only on Teller's own request, was he, together with his group, relieved of further responsibility for work on the wartime development of the atomic bomb. A letter from Oppenheimer to Groves on May 1, 1944, seeking to replace Teller with Rudolf Peierls, corroborates Bethe's account. "These calculations," it says in part, "were originally under the supervision of Teller, who is, in my opinion and Bethe's, quite unsuited for this responsibility. Bethe feels that he needs a man under him to handle the implosion program. It was," Oppenheimer notes, "a question of the greatest urgency." Ulam remembers that Teller threatened to leave. Oppenheimer stepped in then to save him for the project. He encouraged Teller to give himself over to the super. Encouragement, Teller wrote in 1955, perhaps disingenuously, that he needed to move him on from the immediate task at hand. "Oppenheimer continued to urge me, with detailed and helpful advice, to keep exploring what lay beyond the immediate aims of the laboratory. This was not easy advice to give, nor was it easy to take. It is easier to participate in the work of the scientific community, particularly when a goal of the highest interest and urgency has been clearly defined. Every one of us considered the present war and the completion of the A-bomb as the problems to which we wanted to contribute most. Nevertheless, Oppenheimer and many of the most prominent men in the laboratory continued to say that the job at Los Alamos would not be complete if we should remain in doubt whether or not a thermonuclear bomb was feasible." To that end, Oppenheimer in May discussed tritium production with Groves and DuPont's Crawford Greenwald. The chemical company had built a pilot-scale, air-cooled pile at Oak Ridge that produced neutrons to spare. Greenwald agreed to put some of them to use, bombarding lithium. Teller departed the theoretical division. Rudolf Peierls took his place. Oppenheimer arranged then to meet with Teller weekly for an hour of freewheeling talk. That was a remarkable concession when the laboratory was working overtime 6 days a week to build a bomb before the end of the war. Oppenheimer may well have thought Teller's imaginative originality worth it. He also understood his extreme sensitivity to slight. Later that summer, when Cherwell visited Los Alamos, Oppenheimer gave a party and inadvertently failed to invite Peierls, who was deputy head of the British mission under James Chadwick. Oppenheimer sought out Peierls the next day and apologized, adding, "But there is an element of relief in this situation. It might have happened with Edward Teller." George Kistiakowsky adjusted himself to Seth Neddermeyer until he felt that not only he but also the project was suffering. Then he reviewed his alternatives and on June 3rd wrote Oppenheimer a memorandum. He and Neddermeyer had established a certain modus vivendi, he wrote, but it was not what he had been asked to do, which was to administer implosion work while Neddermeyer did the science, and it was not based on mutual confidence and a friendly give and take. He proposed 3 possible solutions. He could resign, the solution he thought best and fairest to Neddermeyer, or Neddermeyer could resign. But that would disturb his staff and slow the work. It would also be unfair to a good physicist. Or Neddermeyer could take over more vigorous scientific and technical direction of the project, but dissociate himself completely from all administrative and personnel matters. Oppenheimer had come to value Kistiakowsky too highly to choose any of these alternatives. He proposed a 4th. Kistiakowsky worked out the details, and the men met painfully to present it to Neddermeyer on a Thursday evening in mid-June. Kistiakowsky would assume full responsibility for implosion work as an associate division leader under Parsons. Neddermeyer and Luis Alvarez, recently arrived from Chicago, would become senior technical advisors. Neddermeyer left the meeting early, as well he might. "I'm asking you to accept the assignment," Oppenheimer wrote him the same evening, "in behalf of the success of the whole project, as well as the peace of mind and effectiveness of the workers in the HE program. I am making this request of you. I hope you will be able to accept it." With enduring bitterness, Nettermeyer did. The air-cooled pilot-scale reactor at Oak Ridge had gone critical at 5 o'clock in the morning on November 4, 1943. The loading crews, realizing during the night that they were nearing criticality sooner than expected, had enjoyed rousting Arthur Compton and Enrico Fermi out of bed at the Oak Ridge guesthouse to witness the event. The pile, which was designated X-10, was a graphite cube 24 feet on a side, drilled with 1,248 channels that could be loaded with canned uranium metal slugs and through which large fans blew cooling air. The channels extended for loading through the 7 feet of the high-density concrete that composed the pile face. At the back, they opened onto a subterranean pool, like the pools planned for Hanford, into which irradiated slugs could be pushed to shield them until they lost their more intense short-term radioactivity. Chemists then processed the slugs in a remote-controlled pilot-scale separations plant using the chemical separation process Glenn Seaborg and his colleagues had developed at ultra-microchemical scale in Chicago. A few days before Compton moved to Oak Ridge to supervise the X-10 operation, at the end of November, workers discharged the first 5 tons of irradiated uranium from the pile. Chemical separations began the following month. By the summer of 1944, batches of plutonium nitrate containing gram quantities of plutonium had begun arriving in Los Alamos. The man-made element was quickly used and reused in extensive experiments to study its unfamiliar chemistry and metallurgy. More than 2,000 separate experiments by the end of the summer. Not chemistry or metallurgy, but physics, nearly condemned the plutonium bomb to failure that summer. More than a year previously, Glenn Seaborg had warned that the isotope Pu-240 might form along with the desirable Pu-239 when uranium was irradiated to make plutonium. Pu-240, an even-numbered isotope, was likely to exhibit a much higher rate of spontaneous fission than Pu-239. The plutonium samples Emilio Segre had studied at his isolated log cabin laboratory fissioned spontaneously at acceptable rates. They had been transmuted from uranium in one of the Berkeley cyclotrons. U-238 needed one neutron to transmute to Pu-239. For Pu-240, it required two, and far more neutrons bombarded the uranium slugs cooking in the X-10 pile than a cyclotron could generate. When Segre measured the spontaneous fission rate of the X-10 plutonium, he found it much higher than the Berkeley rate. The rate for Hanford plutonium, which would be exposed to an even heavier neutron flux, was likely to be higher still. That meant they would not need to cleanse the plutonium so thoroughly of light element impurities. But it also signaled catastrophe. They could not use a gun to assemble a critical mass of such stuff. Approaching each other, even at 3,000 feet per second, the plutonium bullet and target would melt down and fizzle before the two parts had time to join. Oppenheimer alerted Conant on July 11th. The two men met with Compton, Groves, Nichols, and Fermi in Chicago 6 days later, and the next day Oppenheimer wrote Groves to confirm their conclusions. Pu-240 was apparently long-lived, and since the two isotopes were elementally identical, it could not be removed chemically. They had not considered separating Pu-239 from Pu-240 electromagnetically. Such an effort, with isotopes that differed by only one mass unit and were highly toxic, would dwarf the vast Calutron operation at Oak Ridge and could not possibly be accomplished in time to influence the outcome of the war. "It appears reasonable," Oppenheimer ended, "to discontinue the intensive effort to achieve higher purity for plutonium and to concentrate attention on methods of assembly which do not require a low neutron background for their success. At the present time, the method to which an overriding priority must be assigned is the method of implosion." That necessity was painful, as the Los Alamos technical history makes clear. The implosion was the only real hope, and from current evidence, not a very good one. Oppenheimer agonized over the problem to the point that he considered resigning his directorship. Robert Bacher, the sturdy leader of the experimental physics division, took long walks with him in those days to share his pain, and eventually dissuaded him. There was no one else who could do the job, Bacher argued. Without Oppenheimer, there would be no bomb in time to shorten the war and save lives. Action changed Oppenheimer's mood. The laboratory had at this time strong reserves of techniques, of trained manpower, and of morale, says the technical history. It was decided to attack the problems of the implosion with every means available, to throw the book at it. Going over the prospects with Bacher and Kistiakowsky, Oppenheimer decided to carve two new divisions out of Parsons' Ordnance Division, G for Gadget, under Bacher, to master the physics of implosion, and X for Explosives, under Kistiakowsky, to perfect explosive lenses. The Navy captain howled, Kistiakowsky remembers. Oppenheimer called a big meeting of all the group heads, and there he sprang on Parsons the fact that I had plans for completely redesigning the explosives establishment. Parsons was furious. He felt that I had bypassed him, and that was outrageous. I can understand perfectly how he felt, but I was a civilian, so was Oppie, and I didn't have to go through him. From then on, Parsons and I were not on good terms. He was extremely suspicious of me. Parsons had his hands full, in any case, designing the uranium gun, Little Boy, and arranging its eventual use. Oppenheimer prevailed. They would throw the book at implosion. In the months ahead, the laboratory, which had swollen to 1,207 full-time employees by the previous May, would once again double and redouble in size. Philip Abelson, the young Berkeley physicist to whom Luis Alvarez had run from his barber chair in January 1939 to announce the news of fission, had moved to the Naval Research Laboratory in 1941 to work on uranium enrichment for the Navy, and had made valuable progress independently of the Manhattan Project in the intervening years. The Navy was interested in nuclear power as a motive force for submarines to extend their range and to allow them to travel farther submerged. But a pile of the sort Fermi would build would be unwieldy. It had become pretty obvious, Abelson recalls, that a reactor fueled with natural uranium would be big as a barn. Increase the ratio of U-235 to U-238 in the reactor fuel, enrich the uranium, and the reactor could be correspondingly smaller, with enough enrichment, small enough to fit inside the hull of a submarine in the space previously reserved for diesel engines, batteries, and fuel. Enrichment and separation are different goals, but the same technologies achieve them. Abelson began work by looking up the record of those technologies. Gaseous barrier diffusion was under study then at Columbia, electromagnetic separation at Berkeley, centrifuge separation at the University of Virginia. Abelson decided to try a process that had been pioneered in Germany before the war, liquid thermal diffusion. Using glass tubes, Otto Frisch had experimented unsuccessfully with a similar process, gaseous thermal diffusion, at Birmingham. Thermal diffusion relied on the tendency of lighter isotopes to diffuse toward a hotter region, while heavier isotopes diffused toward a colder region. The mechanism for driving such diffusion could be simple, a hot pipe inside a cold pipe, with liquid uranium hexafluoride flowing between the two pipe walls. Depending on the difference in temperature and the spacing between the two pipes, more or less diffusion would occur. At the same time, the heating and cooling of the hex would start a convection current flowing up the hot pipe wall and down the cold. That would bring the U-235 enriched fluid to the top of the column where it could be tapped off. To increase the enrichment, a number of columns could be connected in series to make a cascade, like the cascade of barrier tanks planned for K-25. Abelson's first technical contribution in 1941 was inventing a relatively cheap way to make uranium hexafluoride. He processed the first 100 kilograms of hex produced in the United States. For the nominal sum of $1, the Army contracted to borrow his patented process for Oak Ridge. He never saw the dollar. The experimental thermal diffusion columns Abelson built at the Naval Research Laboratory in 1941 and 1942 were 36 feet tall, each consisting of three pipes arranged one inside the other. The hot inner pipe, 1¼ inches in diameter, carried high-pressure steam at about 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Surrounding that nickel pipe, a copper pipe contained the liquid hex. The critical spacing between the two pipes, where the hex flowed, measured only about 1/10 of an inch. Surrounding both pipes, a 4-inch pipe of galvanized iron carried water at about 130 degrees, just above hex's melting point, to cool the hex. Pumps that circulated the water were the only moving parts. The apparatus was run continuously with no shutdown or breakdown whatsoever, Abelson reported to the Navy early in 1943. Indeed, so constant were the various temperatures and operating characteristics that practically no attention was required to ensure successful operation. Many days passed in which operating personnel did not touch any control device. To stop the flow of the hex out of a column, Abelson simply dipped the bend of a U-shaped metal drain tube into a bucket of dry ice and alcohol, which froze the hex and plugged the tube. A flame to warm the tube started the flow again. Abelson's January 4, 1943 report, submitted jointly with his NRL colleague, Ross Gunn, indicated that uranium could be enriched within a single thermal diffusion column from its natural U-235 content of 0.7% up to 1% or better. With several thousand columns connected in series, Abelson thought he could produce 90% pure U-235 at the rate of 1 kilogram per day at a total construction cost of no more than $26 million. 90% purity was entirely sufficient to make a bomb. That estimate proved optimistic, however, and equilibrium time for such a cascade appeared to be as long as 600 days. Another choice, more in keeping with the Navy's interest in submarine propulsion, emphasized quantity enrichment rather than quality. Abelson proposed building a plant of 348-foot columns operating in parallel to make large amounts of slightly enriched uranium immediately. Chicago could use such slightly enriched uranium to advance its pile work, Abelson thought. He did not yet know that CP-1 had gone critical just 1 month before his report. Information concerning the many experiments performed by the Chicago workers in the last 6 months has been denied to us, he complained. It is vitally necessary that there be an exchange of technical information if proper plans are to be made for future plants. The NRL had been the first research center Groves visited when he took charge of the Manhattan Project in September 1942. Months before then, Franklin Roosevelt had specifically instructed Vannevar Bush to exclude the Navy from atomic bomb development. Groves followed the NRL's research, and Bush encouraged its funding through the Military Policy Committee. But by 1943, the official flow of information on nuclear energy research ran from the Navy to the Army, one way only. Unofficially, however, several of Groves's compartments leaked. In November 1943, the Navy authorized Abelson to build his 300-column plant. He had searched for a sufficient source of steam. Thermal diffusion used volcanic magnitudes of steam, one reason the Manhattan Project had chosen not to pursue it, and located the Naval Boiler and Turbine Laboratory at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. They were testing good-sized boilers that would go into ships, Abelson says. They had the capability of making quantities of steam at 1,000 pounds per square inch, and they had Navy people standing 24-hour watches to deliver the steam. The boiler laboratory's waste steam would supply his 300-column plant, but before scaling up that far, he planned to test his design by building and operating only the first 100 columns. Construction began in January 1944, with completion scheduled for July. By now, Abelson knew more about the Manhattan Project. He knew that the barriers, which Hodiah Hershey had been stripped and re-equipped to manufacture, were not yet passing inspection, and that K-25, the gaseous diffusion plant, was therefore woefully behind schedule. He knew Los Alamos had been founded with Robert Oppenheimer as its director. He knew Berkeley was struggling to make its calutrons work. He saw that his thermal diffusion process might come to the bomb project's rescue, and he was generous enough and worried enough about the war to offer it, despite the Army's several previous rebuffs. He chose not to work through the limited official channels that the Army and the OSRD had devised to constrict the flow of information. I wanted to let Oppenheimer know what we were doing. Someone in the Bureau of Ships knew one of the people in the Navy Bureau of Ordnance who was going out to Los Alamos. I remember that I met the man at the old Warner Theater here in Washington, up in the balcony, real cloak-and-dagger stuff. Abelson briefed the Bureau officer about the plant he was building. He said that he expected to be producing 5 grams a day of material enriched to 5% U-235 by July. This vital information the Bureau man carried to Los Alamos and passed along to Edward Teller. Teller, in turn, briefed Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer apparently conspired then with Deke Parsons, the Hill's ranking Navy man, to concoct a cover story that Parsons had learned of the Abelson work on a visit to the Philadelphia Navy Yard. With the Navy thus protected, Oppenheimer on April 28th alerted Groves. Oppenheimer had seen Abelson's January 1943 report only a few months previously, a year after it was written. He was not impressed. Like his colleagues, Oppenheimer had considered only those processes that enriched natural uranium all the way up to bomb grade, a requirement thermal diffusion could not efficiently meet. Now, he realized that Abelson's process offered a valuable alternative. The alternative Abelson had proposed in his report to help Chicago advance its pile work, slight enrichment of larger quantities. Feeding even slightly enriched material into the Oak Ridge calutrons would greatly increase their efficiency. A thermal diffusion plant could therefore substitute, at least temporarily, for the stalled lower stages of the K-25 plant and supplement the output of the alpha calutrons. Abelson's 100-column plant, with the columns operating in parallel, Oppenheimer calculated, should produce about 12 kilograms a day of uranium of 1% enrichment. Dr. Oppenheimer suddenly told me that we had made a terrible scientific blunder, Groves testified after the war. I think he was right. It is one of the things that I regret the most in the whole course of the operation. We had failed to consider thermal diffusion as a portion of the process as a whole. From the beginning, the leaders of the Manhattan Project had thought of the several enrichment and separation processes as competing horses in a race that had blinded them to the possibility of harnessing the processes together. Groves had partly opened his eyes when barrier troubles delayed K-25. Then he had decided to cancel the upper stages of the K-25 cascade and feed the lower stage product to the beta calutrons for final enrichment. So he was prepared to understand immediately Oppenheimer's similar point about the value of a thermal diffusion plant. I had once decided that the idea was well worth investigating. Groves appointed a committee of men thoroughly experienced by now in Manhattan Project troubleshooting. W.K. Lewis, Ager Murphy, and Richard Tolman. They visited the Philadelphia Navy Yard on June 1st and turned in their conclusions on June 3rd. They thought Oppenheimer's estimate of 12 kilograms a day of 1% U-235 optimistic, but emphasized the possibility, with 300 columns instead of 100, of producing 30 kilograms per day of 0.95% U-235. Groves thought bigger than that. He had a power plant with 238,000 kilowatts rated capacity coming online within weeks in the K-25 area at Oak Ridge that K-25 would not be ready to draw on until the end of the year. It was designed to generate electricity to run the barrier diffusers, but it made electricity by making steam. The steam could serve a thermal diffusion plant that would enrich uranium for the alpha and beta calutrons until such time as K-25 needed electricity. Then the permanent K-25 installation could be phased in gradually, and the temporary thermal diffusion plant phased out. The proposal cleared the Military Policy Committee on June 12, 1944. On June 18th, Groves contracted with the engineering firm of H.K. Ferguson to build a 2,100-column thermal diffusion plant beside the power plant on the Clinch River in 90 days or less. That extraordinary deadline allowed no time for design. Ferguson would assemble the operation from 21 identical copies, Chinese copies, Groves called them, of Philip Abelson's 100-column unit in the Philadelphia Navy Yard. The general must have appreciated the fortuity of his decision when he learned the following month of the plutonium crisis at Los Alamos. But the thermal diffusion plant was not immediately Oak Ridge's savior. Ferguson managed to build a capacious 500-foot barn of black metal siding and begin operating the first rack of columns in 69 days by September 16th. But steam leaked out almost as fast as it could be blown in, and couplings needed extensive repair and even partial redesign. The gaseous diffusion plant, K-25, was more than half completed, but no barrier tubes shipped from Houdai Hershey yet met even minimum standards. The alpha calutrons smeared uranium all over the insides of their vacuum tanks, catching no more than 4% of the U-235. That valuable fraction, reprocessed and fed into the beta calutrons, reached the beta collectors in turn at only 5% efficiency. 5% of 4% is 2/1000. A speck of U-235 stuck to an operator's coveralls was well worth searching out with a Geiger counter and retrieving delicately with tweezers. No essence was ever expressed more expensively from the substance of the world, with the possible exception of the human soul. In the Pacific, the island war advanced. As the army under General Douglas MacArthur pushed up from Australia, across New Guinea toward the Philippines, the Marines under Admiral Chester Nimitz island-hopped from Guadalcanal to Bougainvillea in the Solomons, north across the equator to Tarawa in the Gilberts, farther north to Kwajalein and Eniwetok in the Marshalls. That brought them, by the summer of 1944, within striking distance of the Japanese inner defense perimeter to the west. Its nearest bastions were the Marianas, a chain of volcanic islands at the right corner of a roughly equilateral triangle, of which the Philippine main island of Luzon was the left corner and the Japanese main island of Honshu the apex. The United States wanted the Marianas as primary bases for further advance. Guam for the Navy, Saipan and Tinian for the new B-29 superfortresses that the Army Air Force had begun deploying temporarily at great risk and expense in China's Sichuan province, ferrying aviation fuel and bombs over the Himalayas to support their mission, which was the high-altitude precision bombing of Japan. By contrast, only 1,500 miles of open water separated Saipan and Tinian from Tokyo, and the islands could be supplied securely by sea. Nimitz named the Marianas campaign Operation Forager. It began in mid-June with heavy bombing of the island airfields. Then 535 ships, carrying 127,571 troops, sailed from Eniwetok, the largest force of men and ships yet assembled for a Pacific naval operation. "We are through with flat atolls now," Holland Smith, the Marine commanding general, briefed his officers. "We learned to pulverize atolls, but now we are up against mountains and caves where Japs can dig in. A week from now, there will be a lot of dead Marines." Intelligence estimates put 15,000 to 17,000 Japanese troops on Saipan, 10,000 on smaller Tinian, 3 miles to the south. The Marines invaded Saipan first, on the morning of June 15th, and won a long but shallow beachhead onto which, by afternoon, Amphitrax had delivered 20,000 men. Time correspondent Robert Sherrod was among them, dodging shells from Japanese artillery inland. He had seen action before, on the Aleutian island of Attu and on Tarawa, and knew the Japanese as America had come to know them. Nowhere have I seen the nature of the Jap better illustrated than it was near the airstrip at dusk. I had been digging a foxhole for the night when one man shouted, "There's a Jap under those logs!" The command post security officer was dubious, but he handed concussion grenades to a man and told him to blast the Jap out. Then a sharp ping of the Jap bullet whistled out of the hole, and from under the logs a skinny little fellow, not much over 5 feet tall, jumped out, waving a bayonet. An American tossed a grenade, and it knocked the Jap down. He struggled up, pointed his bayonet into his stomach, and tried to cut himself open in approved harikari fashion. The disemboweling never came off. Someone shot the Jap with a carbine. But, like all Japs, he took a lot of killing. Even after 4 bullets had thudded into his body, he rose to 1 knee. Then the American shot him through the head, and the Jap was dead. While the Marines advanced into Saipan, fighting off the harrowing Japanese frontal assaults they learned to call bonsai charges, 155-millimeter long toms brought ashore and set up in the southern sector of the island began softening up Tinian. That smaller island of 38 square miles, 10 miles long and shaped much like Manhattan, was far less rugged than Saipan. Its highest elevation, Mount Lasso, rose only 564 feet above sea level. Its lowlands were planted in sugarcane. It had roads and a railway to recommend it to tank operations. To the disadvantage of amphibious assault, the island was a raised platform, protected on all sides by steep cliffs 500 to 600 feet high. The Rock, the Marines would come to call it. It had two major beaches, one near Tinian Town on the southwest coast, and the other, which the Marines named Yellow, on the east coast at the island's waist. Navy frogmen explored both by night and found them heavily mined and defended. Two other smaller beaches on the northwest coast hardly deserve the name. One was 60 yards long and the other 150 yards. The United States had made no division-strength landings across any beach less than twice the length of those two toeholds combined in the entire course of the war. The Japanese on Tinian accordingly defended them with nothing more than a few mines and two 25-man blockhouses. The Marines coded them White 1 and White 2 and chose them for their assault. The invasion of Tinian began on July 24th, 2 weeks after Saipan had been secured. Because of the larger island's proximity, the Marines could deploy shore-to-shore rather than ship-to-shore, embarking in LSTs and smaller craft directly from Saipan. A feint at Tinian Town Beach decoyed the Japanese defenses, and the invaders achieved complete tactical surprise, rushing ashore and pushing inland as fast as possible to escape the dangerously narrow landings. By the end of the day, when the advance halted to organize a solid defense against the Japanese troops rushing up the island from Tinian Town, most of the tanks had been brought ashore. Four howitzer batteries were in place, and a spare battalion was even at hand. The defenders had killed 15 Marines and wounded fewer than 200. The American perimeter extended inland more than 2 miles. With the coming of darkness, the Japanese began a mortar barrage. Near midnight, their artillery arrived and they added it in. The Marines answered with their howitzers. To watch for the expected Japanese counterattack, they illuminated the area with flares. The attack started at 0300 hours, Japanese soldiers rushing the American lines head-on in the naked light of the flares. Against strong Marine defenses, challenge quickly became slaughter. The Marines needed only 4 days to advance down the island. They encountered tanks and infantry, and in the mild terrain easily destroyed them. They took Tinian Town on July 31st. That night shattered a last bonsai charge from the south, and the next day, August 1st, 1944, declared the island secure. More than 6,000 Japanese combatants died, compared to 300 Americans. Another 1,500 Marines were wounded. Soon the Seabees would arrive to begin bulldozing airfields. Saipan before had been bloodier. 13,000 U.S. casualties, 3,000 Marines killed, 30,000 Japanese defenders dead. But a more grotesque slaughter had engulfed the island's population of civilians. Believing, as propaganda had prepared them, that the Americans would visit upon them rape, torture, castration, and murder, 22,000 Japanese civilians had made their way to two sea cliffs, 80 and 1,000 feet high, above jagged rocks. And, despite appeals from Japanese-speaking American interpreters and even fellow islanders, had flung themselves